Okay, we are coming down to the home stretch here. We are on chapter 8.
Wait, did I miss chapter 7? I don't have anything written on my notes.
I was gone
last week. And I wasn't here last week.
You were driving back. Chapter 7.
You weren't here last week.
Okay.
Wow.
That's why you don't
know. No, that's chapter 8.
That's my memory.
So we're starting chapter 8, you said?
Couldn't remember.
Yeah, chapter 8.
Oh, look at that. You guys did all that last week.
It's on page 14.
You were really cool.
Does anybody need a copy of the... of the seventh dwelling place? I made a couple extra copies if you need it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, okay, good. I always take it.
Yeah, I remember. I was in Minnesota and we landed.
Yeah, I know. Thank you.
Oh, it's 7. Okay.
So after we finish 8,
so I can't see. Okay.
And then we got a couple of more, and then we'll do the seventh dwelling place. And so we'll finish that after the first of the year. So this study has spanned 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah,
really. Are you serious?
Well, not the whole 2 years, but we started it in 2023. We'll finish it in 2024.
This one. Yeah. Tina said she wants to know when we're starting the psalm. She's interested. Yeah.
Okay, sure. Good. Okay. In chapter 8, Teresa's kind of lumping these chapters over a particular theme. And in chapter 8, she discusses how God communicates to the soul through intellectual visions and their effects if the visions are genuine. She begins by saying, in chapter 8, she begins by saying, the further a soul advances, the more it is accompanied by the good Jesus. We will do well to discuss how, when His Majesty desires, we cannot do otherwise than walk always with Him. This is evident in the ways and modes by which His Majesty communicates Himself to us and shows us the love He bears us. He does this through some very wonderful apparitions and visions. Note she differentiates between apparitions and visions. She then says we praise Him because though He is filled with majesty and power, He nonetheless desires to communicate thus with a creature. So now she's the intimacy of the communication between God and the soul is growing in a constant, you know. So it's always increasing, and the way He interfaces with the soul is always increasing. He's drawing you. It's like He's drawing you further and further into His kingdom. You know, He's bringing you more and more into His embrace, and that's the, you know. So He's communicating Himself, but also showing you how much He loves you. And that's really an amazing thing, you know, when you think that the guy who created the universe, I say the guy, the God who created the universe with just an act of His will, cares enough about you as an individual to want to draw you to Himself individually and show you how much He loves you. To me, that just boggles my mind, you know.
And you know that saying, He delights in being with the children of men.
Yeah.
I mean, to delight God.
Yeah.
Therese understood that.
Yeah.
She understood that.
Yeah, He does. He just...
It's amazing.
I read somewhere, I forget who wrote it, that His delight is to be with the children of men.
Yeah.
Maybe she's the one who wrote it. I don't know. I don't remember.
Really.
Been a long time.
Yeah.
But that love He has for us is something that people don't really appreciate much.
No.
You know, you don't... When you look at what's going on in the world, people just don't appreciate the fact that...
They rather think God will get you for that.
Yeah,
I hear that
exactly,
all the time.
Yeah.
He's a punishing God. Mm-hmm. He doesn't.
Did you see at that one school they're starting a Satan club?
Oh, yes.
I saw that on TV.
Yeah. It's terrible.
Oh. It's getting to the point where they think, well, that's okay, but gosh, I don't know.
It's not okay.
It's not.
But before Christ comes again, it will appear as though Satan has won. Mm-hmm. So I figure by the end of the week...
Time for next week to come.
I don't know. I think it's gonna.
Yeah.
I don't know if we hit the peak.
Yeah. So she says, when the soul does not expect it, the soul is suddenly aware of His presence. She says it will feel Jesus Christ, our Lord, beside it. Mm-hmm. It does not see Him, either with the eyes of the body or with those of the soul. This is called an intellectual vision. I don't know why. So she didn't know why they call it that, but it's something where you know it's there. You can sense these right next to you, but you don't see them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you got a blindfolder on.
It's more a feeling.
Yeah.
You feel his presence.
Yeah, you do.
You wouldn't think of that as, she says, vision.
Yeah, and she says that. She says, it will feel Jesus Christ, our Lord, beside it.
Yeah.
So you feel it. It's like you have a blindfold on, but you feel him right next to you. You know he's there, even if you can't see him.
Yeah. Well, I feel my husband, like my house, when he died, the house never felt empty. It's filled with his presence. And
isn't
I feel
that great?
That. It's amazing. I always laugh. I send John, I go, oh, where are you, John? I look at his picture, you know. He's all around.
Yeah, it's
great. When Jesus first experienced this, she was quite worried in the beginning because since she didn't see anything, she couldn't understand the nature of this vision. However, she knew so certainly that it was Jesus Christ, our Lord, who showed himself to her in a way that she couldn't doubt. I mean, she couldn't doubt the vision was there. She had never heard of an intellectual vision, nor had she thought there was such a kind. But she understood very clearly that it was the same Lord who often spoke to her in the way previously mentioned, locutions. So she knows he's there, and he's communicating with her, but in a way he has not done before.
And who told her that it's called an intellectual vision?
Or? Probably some confessors or something. Because you see it, you're aware of it in your mind, but you don't see it with any kind of eyes of the soul or the eyes of the body.
So did he speak to her in that vision?
Yeah. Teresa then went to her confessor to tell him what was going on. Her confessor, unfamiliar with such visions, asked her how, if she didn't see anything, she knew it was our Lord and what kind of face he had. This confessor was clearly confused. Since she didn't see anything, she obviously could not describe his face. Mm-hmm. All Teresa could say was that she told him all she knew and the vision had not been fancied. It wasn't something she just dreamed up. Hmm. Teresa then says that although some people put many fears in her, she was still frequently unable to doubt, especially when the Lord said to her, "Do not be afraid, it is I." Boy, how often he said that in the Gospels,
mm-hmm.
huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was telling it to her, too. Mm-hmm. These words had so much power that from then on she could not doubt the vision, and she was left very much strengthened and happy over such. With such good company. So she's really happy that this is happening, and she feels very comfortable around him. And I started, you know, thinking about that. Would you feel comfortable if you knew that he was right next to you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wouldn't you feel wonderful?
I think you would feel really...
You wouldn't have any worries.
I think you'd feel amazed.
Yeah. Right.
You know, if that happened to me, I would feel absolutely amazed.
Yeah, I always use this word. If God blows your mind. I'm always saying that to Father Smith. He blows your mind. He's so awesome, God.
Don't you think this vision would be more prevalent because you're not seeing him, but you're just feeling him next to you? Don't you think that... I would think that would be more common than actually seeing a vision.
Yeah, well, I don't know, because from what she was saying here, previously, she could actually see him and he would speak to her.
Yeah.
So this was a new thing, and she'd already done the other.
Yeah.
But he's just coming at different ways. What he's proved to her is that he can come to her any way he wants.
I guess that's for us to see.
Yeah.
There's different ways.
That's different ways.
Yeah.
Because he'll teach you different ways, he'll come to you different ways. Mm. You know, there's no limit to the way he can communicate with you.
Does she say this is a lower level of a way of seeing, of, you know?
Well, we're in the sixth dwelling place, chapter 8, so I think it's not exactly a lower level.
You know what I mean? You're not seeing him.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Wow.
So she saw clearly that the vision was a great help toward walking with a habitual remembrance of God, and a deep concern about avoiding anything displeasing to him. For it seemed to her that he was always looking at her. I misspelled the word there. It should be looking at, looing. Looking at her. And each time she wanted to speak with his majesty in prayer, and even outside of it, she felt he was so near that he couldn't fail to hear her. She felt he was walking at her right side. And that's interesting, too. Mm. Because we always do everything on the right, you know. Mm-hmm. A priest blesses you with his right hand. Mm-hmm. You genuflect in your right knee. Mm-hmm. All that kind of stuff. But she didn't experience this with those senses by which we can know that a person is beside us. This vision comes in another, more delicate way. Mm. In the visions that come through the senses, one can be deceived, but not in the intellectual vision. For this latter brings great interior benefits and effects that couldn't be present if the experience were caused by melancholy, which is her term for mental illness, nor would the devil produce so much good, nor would the soul go about with such peace and continual desire to please God. It's interesting she mentions that he's walking on her right side. Mm-hmm. When you're in the military, the person who's of higher rank is always walking on your right side.
Really?
Mm. You know, and I don't know where that came from, but that's interesting that he does this. And it, you know, and if you look at the Satanists when they do their black mass thing and all, they always do everything left.
Oh, really?
You know, they'll genuflect on the left knee, do the sign of cross backwards with the left hand, all the kind of stuff like this. And the word for left in Latin is sinister.
Sinister.
Which is the root for our word sinister, which is interesting. You know, I was over at a mass one day it was a school mass, and I noticed one of the teachers came in and genuflected on her left knee. And her kids were little kids. And so I saw her after mass, and I said, you know, can I mention something to you? And she said, yes. Yeah. I said, I noticed you genuflect on your left knee. And I said, you really ought to genuflect on your right knee. And I teach the children to do the same thing. And I told her why. And then a couple of weeks later, I saw him in mass again. She was still genuflecting on her left knee.
Maybe she had a total knee.
So either she was stubborn or...
That would bug me. You know, that's where I'm human. It's like, mad. That's...
So it just...
Oh.
So I don't know if you just... got upset.
It was such a habit, maybe.
She was just mad because I corrected her.
But it's her dominant side.
Yeah.
She's left-handed or something.
Could be.
Interesting.
But they always tell you, you know, always make the sign across with your right hand and everything. Mm-hmm. Never with the left.
Yeah.
Never with the left. But I see people all the time genuflecting on the left knee.
Even in church on Sunday, some of them will come in.
I see it all the time.
And you know the nativity set. Mary is supposed to be on the right of the baby Jesus and Saint Joseph.
Oh, thank you. I didn't know that.
But when you look around in the stories, there are some the opposite.
Yeah. Well, in the churches too, when the crucifix is up there, Mary's on his right.
Yeah.
And Joseph is on his left.
Usually. Okay, so when I go home, I go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of just put it right over him, like in the center. I never thought about putting...
Yeah, and we see in our creed that he ascended to heaven and sits at the
right hand of the Father.
You know?
Yeah.
So it does have a meaning. Mm-hmm. It's not just some arbitrary thing, you know?
All of it has a meaning, you know? It's all intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, we see a little glimpse of it, and you're like,
what we're not seeing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you were to experience something you thought might be an intellectual vision, what signs would you look for to be convinced that it's real and not imaginary or from the devil?
Well, isn't she at this stage not supposed to be, the devil's not even supposed to be able to get at her anymore?
Well, he can't do much harm unless you let him at this point. But he'll still try.
She would feel peace and joy, and it wouldn't go away.
Yeah, you'd have peace from it.
Yeah.
And a desire to please God more.
Exactly. And you also have that certainty that she's talking about here.
Yeah,
you would be absolutely certain that it was Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't... Yeah. Oh, gee, I wonder if that was him. There wouldn't be any doubt. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
Because if she told people, a lot of them would think she was nuts. So she would have to know.
Yeah, herself. That's the problem she has with the confessor, too.
Why not?
The problem she had with the confessors, and they don't go into a lot of detail here, but, you know, she tells them what's going on with her, and they don't believe her, so they tell her that it's all her imagination and to ignore it. And so to receive absolution, she's got to do what her confessor says, right? Mm. So how's she going to do that?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like the thing that the problem Jesus gave Faustina when he told her to do something, and her mother superior told her to do something different, and she said, "What do I do?" Mm-hmm. He says, "Obey your superior."
Yeah, you know, he always does.
I'll put her there. So after explaining that the soul is not capable of producing this vision on its own, Teresa says, "This favor bears with it a particular knowledge of God. This continual companionship gives rise to a most tender love for His Majesty, to some desires even greater than those previously mentioned, to surrender oneself totally to His service, and to a great purity of conscience, because the presence at His side makes the soul pay attention to everything. Here the truth cannot be forgotten, for the Lord awakens the soul to His presence beside it. The Lord gives it what He desires, and it cannot be acquired. Sometimes also the vision is of some saint, and this too is most beneficial." So this is all happening in a way that she has no control over. She can't cause it to happen. And yet it's giving her that continual awareness of God's presence with her. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, your mama tells you this when you're growing up, right? You know, God's watching you. He knows you. You know, and they do it around Christmas time, you know, with, the elves are watching you. Gotta be good. But as these people mature spiritually, they realize that God is always there. And what Jesus is doing with Teresa, of course, is proving that's really true, that he is always there with her. Always, he never leaves her. And he's always not just there, not just sitting there like a lump on a log, but he's there communicating himself to her. He's trying to let her experience more and more of him.
But you know, I think it's hard not to take him for granted then. If you have that assurance, that kind of faith, and you're just used to it, how do you give the praise and glory that you should?
Right.
I mean, well, I think he
helps you with that. Because when you talk about taking it for granted, I think you can. Once you get to that level, you do take it for granted that he's always there.
You're supposed to be a child,
feel a child. And so your anchor, your parent, your source of everything you need is right there next to you. Mm-hmm. You know, everything you need is right there next to you. And so I think because of that, it makes you tend to be thankful. Mm-hmm. You know?
Thankful, but... You know how we're supposed to concentrate on the passion a lot,
and
constantly pray. Some saints are so flowery in their speech.
Yeah, yeah. Can't do that. Well, last week we talked about how, you know, those kind of things come about, but and she tells us to always meditate on the passion. You know, she mentioned that last time, but to. But you can't do that continuously. You can't do that nonstop, you know. But this is nonstop. When you know that he's right there next to you.
She must have such great confidence.
Yeah. I mean, that's right there.
Yeah. I mean, that would just be like...
She knows it.
Wouldn't we all want that? And she has it, so it shows that, you know, it's possible.
And that
to
idea
be aware of it. It's not
that
like
idea
not
of
here.
Confidence, like you're saying, is also what we find in Teresa Littleflower too. She says her basic approach was to have such tremendous confidence in the love of God that when she prays, she imagines herself crawling up on his knee and then putting her head on his chest, talking to him, just like you would your human father.
I have a book, a little one that's from a priest from years ago. And I can't think of the name of it, but it's about having confidence in God. And it's in the title of it, Confidence, Surrender to Confidence in God. And he says that the whole point is that, you know, we're supposed to have confidence in God every day, you know, all the time.
Yeah,
and we're hurting Jesus by not having confidence, which is the same thing as trust.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah, right.
And it was just all about that. And ask Jesus for more things and have confidence that you are going to get it. if it's his will, obviously. Right.
And the whole Bible's about that, too, really.
Yeah.
Have trust, so that must be hard.
Sure.
Well, so that makes me think she's won the golden ticket. How can we get there? Because she's got it totally, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at the prayer, the fiat to the Eternal Father, he tells you, come to me with confidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, that's basically what he's saying.
Yeah.
Come to me with confidence every morning when you begin your day and tell me what you need from me.
Mm-hmm. And if we had that strong confidence, we would have interior peace because everything is his will. And, okay, so if I get a traffic ticket today, well, that was his will for me to learn a lesson of, I didn't get one, though, today. So I'm just saying, you know, if you got one, or whatever else.
It just doesn't rile you too much.
Yeah.
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 He just accepted it.
Yeah.
And that's the whole message that Claude Descossat talks about, too, where he says, just whatever comes to you each day, accept. Yeah. It's the will of God. Surrender. But that's what God wants you to deal with today.
I was reading one book. It's every moment is the will of God.
Yeah.
Every single moment.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think about that because you make little decisions that have a ripple effect. There was my one daughter lives at home, and there was a thing I got in the neighborhood to have that this girl's looking for a roommate. And, and I told my daughter, now she's pursuing it. And then, we're like, should I have said something? You think?
Yeah.
But, I don't know.
No, you're taken care of.
I was like, it's blaring at me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even those people that are coming out of Palestine, not the Jewish, the others, they only talk about God and prayer, and it seems like they have brought them to this total dependence.
Yeah.
And what they've gone through.
And Jim sent an email about them all dreaming of Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wasn't that
something? That was
interesting.
Yes.
Yes. I've told a lot of people that. I don't think
I said that to a lot, too. I have a lot of people that are saying.
Yeah, it's like 200 people.
200, yeah.
Come on.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big sign there. That's amazing. That's not just some happened.
Well, it shows he's starting to work.
Oh, yeah.
He's starting to do something, and we don't know what the end is going to be. Yeah. Well, we deal with the end is going to be, but...
Yeah. We don't know when.
It's confusing to think that Israel should be allowed to destroy this people. But you look in the Old Testament, and God allowed it.
Well, when he told Joshua to move into Canaan, he said, destroy them, because they'll corrupt you.
Yeah. Doesn't it almost tell you it's okay for Jews to do this?
Well, when you think about it, people think about that. You know, they read that story in Exodus, and Joshua's going over there, and God says, slay all the people. Well, he didn't want to do that. And he didn't. He didn't obey God.
Mm-hmm.
And then all kinds of bad things happened because of that. But people think that because God says, slay these people, because they'll corrupt you, that they're going to go to hell. And it's not the case.
No. And everybody dies sometime, so their turn is now.
Right.
And you have to think about that. Sometimes I think when some people die kind of shockingly early or something, you think, was that because God saw something further down the line and they were going to...
Yeah.
I don't know. This is the best they're going to get, right now.
Or had something for them to do,
I don't know.
It's all like that,
Or, does God take someone so it puts someone else on the path to God?
Could be.
I don't know. I had a cousin just died when I was out visiting my family.
Yeah.
And he's my age. Yeah. So I'm like, oh.
That kind of wakes you up.
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And his daughter's the same age as me. And I'm like, wow.
It's not supposed to happen.
Yeah, he's a real nice guy, too.
Yeah. Look at Mike. He died when he was 54.
Yeah.
You know?
So many people
Amazing
in
priest.
Their 50s are dying.
Yeah.
He was 58, and he was in remission for cancer. I didn't know the whole story.
Was it ball cancer? That's affecting so many young men.
I'll have to find out, but he was in remission, and I guess at Thanksgiving, it came back, and he already died.
Did he get the shot?
I don't know. I don't live there to ask. Most people do get it.
But you look at the writings of Brother Lawrence of the Resurrection, too, And he talks about the same thing, being always aware of the presence of God with you, that he never leaves you. Mm-hmm. And he made a big impression on people. I mean, bishops would come to him and ask his advice about stuff, He was a little dormant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He washed the dishes at the monastery, And his bishops would come and ask him. So, those kind of things really... kind of make you sit up and perk up, okay, what's going on here, you know?
I always worry that, you know, sometimes you make decisions kind of quick.
Yeah.
And then I go back and I go, well, was that a good decision? I didn't really pray about it. I kind of just, yeah. And you're not even thinking about it. I'm like,
yeah, we don't always know, you know.
You just kind of, you know, I was like, yeah. Oh, I should have thought about God at that moment. But I'm just like, you know.
Well, then you have to say, God, fix it.
Yeah. He's probably what like, but you know, if you stood back and prayed in the beginning, you wouldn't be asking me to fix it.
Yeah.
Well, then you might not be talking to him.
Well, the one thing I always pray for every day after I receive the Eucharist is that God inspire all my works and then bless all my works. I always ask him for that, you know, because I don't want to be going off and doing something and just on my own, thinking I'm a know-all, do-all, and, you know, I know
it's
what's best.
Empty.
Yeah. You know, so I need his guidance, you know, for everything.
I do think we get little glimpses of it, that you're on the right path or you're doing something that God wants you to do. Because we were at a family breakfast when I was visiting, and I have those little things from Magigoria, the little claws.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one of my husband's cousins was talking, she just got diagnosed with breast cancer.
Oh, wow.
And she was talking, I don't know, we said we went on this trip. And she said, oh, yeah, Magigoria, I really want to go. And I go,
right.
And she was just so happy to receive
wow,
it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I haven't seen her in like, I don't know how
that
many
was
years.
Just meant to
she
be.
Sat across from me and said it.
Wow.
And she's like, can I touch you? You went there.
No.
Yeah.
But no, she was just so happy to receive it.
But that was all
know?
Coincidence,
yeah.
right?
No. Yeah. I said that to I told my sister-in-law, and she goes, well, you know, that was God winking.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
What is a coincidence is just where God prefers not to be
acknowledged,
noticed, or something.
Yeah. I've got a coffee cup at home that says, no one comes into your life by accident.
Right.
Yeah.
I think
so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah. But you wonder about some of those people.
Yeah. Well, some people come in for a long time and some just for a short
Pass
time.
Through,
you know.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah. My grandmother always used to say that. She said, if there's no more reason that God has ordained for you to be with that person, they sort of go their way.
Oh, that's
Everyone
interesting. Joined.
We grew up with grandma's wise wisdom.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Never
she thought
said, of that.
That's a good,
Yeah.
So Teresa says, after explaining that the soul is not capable of producing this vision on its own, she says this favor bears with it a particular knowledge of God. So that's one of the advantages of this kind of vision. It gives you a particular knowledge of God. This continual companionship gives rise to a most tender love for His Majesty, to some desires even greater than those previously mentioned. I think we read this already, right?
A lot of it sounds like other stuff.
Yeah. So then Teresa poses a question. How, if nothing is seen, does the soul know it is Jesus or a saint of the Blessed Mother? Teresa says the soul will not know how to explain it, but it does know with the greatest certitude. It seems easier to know when the Lord speaks, but what is more amazing is that it knows the saint who doesn't speak, but seemingly is placed there by the Lord as a help to it and as its companion. Thus, there are other spiritual things that one doesn't know how to explain, but through them, one knows how lowly our nature is when there is a question of understanding the sublime grandeurs of God. For we are incapable even of understanding these spiritual things. For since the favors are not granted to all, they should be highly esteemed, and one should strive to perform greater services, since God in so many ways helps the soul to perform these services. This soul thinks that it is more obligated to Him than anyone, and any fault it commits pierces to the core of its being, and very rightly so. She says somewhere else in here too that when you meet a saint, when a saint comes to you, you know this saint.
Mm-hmm.
You know it as if you had been with this person for years.
Wow.
And I thought that was interesting.
That's nice. That's nice. That'd be a nice favor.
Yeah. And so when these saints come in these intellectual visions, even though they don't speak to her, they're still communicating grace to her.
Wow.
They're still showing her, I'm here for you. And I think that's the big message there.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not just, God doesn't just send Himself. He also sends these other saints there to help you. And it just points out the value of the communion of saints, I think, that we're all connected together. Because we're all connected together through Christ. And I think that's one of the big lessons of this particular thing she's talking about right here. That even though he comes to us and he's teaching us, he's still having the saints come and be our companions. He's not our only spiritual companion. We got our guardian angel, but also got the saints.
Yeah, you know, isn't it like we all have favorite saints and novenas? But I was thinking, like, we really know them. Like, I feel like Therese is, you know, like, I know her. And I said, it's so funny how you get this idea. I mean, maybe it's a lifetime of praying to her. But, I mean, a lot of people, they love Therese so much that you feel like you know her, like she was a member of your family. That always boggles my mind.
Because you're talking to her all the time.
It's something. It just, like, it comes.
That's how my sister is with St. Anne.
Yeah.
That's her mother's mother.
Yeah.
She's been very devoted to her whole life.
Yeah.
I was going to ask the one. What?
Is she married?
Yeah. And she's got kids and stuff, you know.
Yes.
But, you know, I've never asked her why, because that's between her and St. Anne. But, for some reason, it just really, because she was a nurse.
Oh.
And so I didn't see any relationship there, you know, as far as occupation or anything goes. But she said, I always had this real devotion to St. Anne.
But we used to say that in high school, dear St. Anne, please send me a man as fast as you can.
Really?
But can't you say the same thing with God? Like, we know, to a degree, like we feel we know God. Like when we see him in person, we're not going to, he's not going to be a stranger.
Yeah.
But like we don't really know him like this much because he's so, but what makes us feel that we know God? You know what I mean? Well, communion, I guess. But it always amazes me, like, we know
His grace.
Other people get grace.
To you.
Yeah.
Grace. That.
Grace is very powerful.
Because other people don't. Like even some of my grandkids.
They don't think about it.
No.
It's not important to them.
No, they don't like to. Blows my mind.
Yeah. And that's something to think about, too, as we go through all these kind of things. Relationship with God has to be something important to you. Otherwise, it's not going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So she has this relationship because she wanted it. She was seeking him. You know, what did Jesus say? Seek and you shall find, right? So she was seeking him, and she found him.
Yeah.
And he found her. But if you're not, you don't care. What do you say about those who are lukewarm? Mm-hmm. I'll vomit you out of my mouth.
Yeah.
You know? Says that in the book of Revelation.
Yeah.
So.
And you would think that every woman that goes into the convent, that's why she's going in. But some of them get distracted and lose it.
Yeah. That's not instant sainthood. I used to think that. I honestly believe when I went to the convent, it's going to be heaven on earth. It was going to be stepping into eternity, and it was going to be the most beautiful thing in the world. I got a
rude awakening.
Rude awakening.
I always thought that they were like, you know, they all had visions of God or were speaking to God and had a higher level than any of us and had no troubles, too.
Well, I think a lot of people go into religious communities like that. Sometimes they're running away from something.
Not
running to something, you know.
Yeah.
And so they, when they finally realize that, then they leave.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing because they'd be miserable if they hadn't.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I had when I was in a seminary, there was a kid in my class, and I asked him, I said, why are you here? And he said, my dad said if I became a priest that he would convert. Oh. And I said, you mean once you become a priest, the whole reason for being a priest goes away because he converted? Then what have you got for reason to be a priest? He looked at me kind of funny. I said, you got to be a priest because God's calling you to that vocation, you know, not because your dad said he'll convert.
Yeah, it's wild ideas people get.
Well, he was trying to help his dad, you know, but I mean, that's
admirable.
It was admirable motive, but not a good reason to be a priest.
And didn't families used to think you send the firstborn in?
There was a priest who used to be a commentator for the Catholic faith on Good Morning America. I can't think of his name, young man. And he was in the priesthood like 20, 25 years and came out, mm-hmm. got the dispensation from Rome and all this stuff. And they asked him why, and he was very honest. He said, I knew my father wanted me to be a priest, and I couldn't disappoint him. And I stayed in as long as I could. Yeah. And he said, I can't live this fake life.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know?
I always thought Dolores Hart, remember she was in the Elvis movies and became a nun and head of it? I always thought from things she said that she kind of was running away from Hollywood and like the sexual atmosphere mm-hmm. of it, and was going up there and trying to get away from it and find peace.
Yeah.
And she must have just stuck with it then.
Elvis Presley was her first kiss.
They interview her regularly on EWTN, so the next time you can listen to it.
So then maybe she, you know, grew into that.
I read her life book. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, and it was a true vocation.
Was it? Okay. I thought, of course it is, because she's made it her whole life.
Yeah. Well, she wrote the book herself, and she explained.
And look at Faustina was at a dance when God asked her why she was doing that. So, it's kind of like Hollywood.
Yeah.
I don't know. You got to give them credit. I don't think it's an easy life.
Yeah. Well, this is very dedicated
life. All those other women.
Yeah. So Teresa explains that if these intellectual visions were from the devil, there would be some outward show of self-esteem and thought of being better than others. But that the soul goes about always so attached to God, and with his thoughts so occupied in him, causes the devil such rage that even though he might try, he would not often return. And God is so faithful that he will not allow the devil much leeway with a soul that doesn't aim for anything else than to please his majesty and spend its life for his honor and glory. He will at once ordain how it must be undeceived. So he's protecting the souls at this point. And then returning to the way the evil might try to tempt the soul, Teresa says, and if he sometimes permits the devil to tempt the soul, he was so ordained that the evil one will be defeated. So he says, give it your best shot, but you're not going to make it. Mm-hmm. It is good that there be fear and that we walk with more care. Nor should you be self-confident, for since you were so favored, you could grow more careless. That also ties with the casualness of the relationship, you know? And I think that's kind of, she's kind of explaining why that doesn't really happen here. Mm-hmm. Because it's not your self-confidence. It's just your realization of how much God, mm-hmm. you know, is protecting you. Because he allows the devil to try, mm-hmm. but he won't let him succeed. And that just makes the devil mad, right? That just gets him all upset. Like when he used to try to beat up Padre Pio every night and it didn't work. If you do not see in yourselves the effects that were mentioned, it will be a sign, you know, all the good things. It will be a sign the favor is not from God. It is good that at the beginning you speak about this vision under the seal of confession with a very learned man, for a learned man will give us light. Or with some very spiritual person, if there be one available. Commend yourself to the Divine Majesty that he has not let you be, that he not let you be deceived. And so you gotta know who you're going to confession to. You gotta find a priest that you think has the level of spirituality you need to be able to discuss this, and he's gonna understand what you're talking about. And if not, you find somebody who's very spiritual that does understand and can talk to you about it. In section 9, Teresa returns to the topic of selecting the right confessor. That was always a big deal for her. She had a lot of problems with that. She says, if the confessor is a person whom, although he practices prayer, the Lord has not led by this path, he will at once be frightened and condemn it. For this reason, I advise you to have a confessor who is very learned and, if possible, also spiritual. And once you have spoken with these persons, be quiet. And don't try to confer about the matter with others. At times, the devil causes some fears so excessive that they force the soul, without us having anything really to fear, not to be satisfied with one consultation. So sometimes you'd be afraid, well, did I hear the right thing? Or did I understand what he told me? Or did he understand what I'm telling him and all? Mm-hmm. And those kind of things. Which shouldn't be feared. You have the kind of fear. You know, if you have a confessor that's a good spiritual guy who understands what you're talking about, he gives you good advice, take it. And then be quiet about it. In section 10, Teresa says, this path is a preparation for becoming a very good servant of God, provided that one cooperates. One should consider the virtues and who it is who serves our Lord with greater mortification, humility, and purity of conscience. This is the one who will be the holiest. In these last sections, and especially if you're looking for a confessor, you look for those kind of characteristics in the confessor. You know, do they have humility, purity of conscience, all those kind of things? They practice the virtues. She's really big on the virtues and the importance of that. In these last sections, Teresa's concerned about having the right confessor and or have the right person to discuss these visions with. She's very concerned about a wrong confessor, possibly being forced to disclose about a wrong confessor possibly being forced to disclose the matters because of the Spanish Inquisition. So there was this push to try to get priests to tell what somebody said in confession, you know. And so she's very worried about that. There were a lot of rumors flying around about what was going on with the Inquisition. Because then they would burn you at the stake if they didn't like what you said, you know. How difficult do you think it'd be to find the right confessor today if you were to experience some of these intellectual visions or any of the other supernatural experiences Teresa has been speaking of?
We got a lot of good young coming up, maybe there.
I think so. Yeah. We got a lot of good young.
I think it would be easier, but in some other areas, right. I think it'd be tough.
Yeah, I think around here it's a lot easier, and I think a lot of people. You know, a lot of the young priests coming in have good formation. You have to find priests who went to a good seminary. I was talking to Mike one day, and he said, in his opinion, there were only about 5 seminaries in the country that were any good.
Oh, there's more than two.
There's more than two. Yeah. Denver's good, you know, and Mount St. Mary's is good and all. But he said only about 5 that were really any good, because the formations coming out of the other ones were not good. I have a good friend, priest. He was down here for a while. He was on medical leave, taking care of his mother and stuff. He's from the Erie Diocese. He's from here, but he was in the Erie Diocese. And then he went back, and he was pastor of 4 different parishes when he was up there because they have so few priests. Mm-hmm. But when he was in a seminary, it was so bad that they would have these costume masses. Clowns and stuff that would dress up in these. They would have these dress up in these costumes and all, you know, and do mass and all.
What was the reasoning behind
to
that?
To with the people, be more.
Oh, it was just so terrible, and it was sacrilege of the mass. Yeah. So he would, but if he complained about it, they'd kick him out of the seminary. He'd never get ordained, and so he was in this beating a rock in a hard place.
Couldn't transfer.
No, he wasn't able to transfer. He tried a couple of times, but he wasn't able to transfer. So whenever this kind of thing happened, he would sneak out at night and go down to a parish where he knew it was pretty good and go to confession, talk to the priest, and then come back and sneak back in again.
Oh, my.
So that was a heck of a way to have to go through the seminary.
That's
so
sad.
What years was that? Like
the 60s.
Well, he's probably in his... almost ready to retire now. He's probably in his 60s.
But why would they? What would they be telling him? Oh, this is okay. Why would you wear a clown costume?
It was just to be relevant to the people, to bring more meaning.
Oh, they do.
Right after Vatican II, you're too young.
Right after Vatican II, they started this kind of stuff.
Crazy.
I had a video of a mass out in California at Halloween time, and all the participants in the mass were in Halloween costumes. The lector had a witch's outfit on with a big pointed hat.
Oh.
The priest had some kind of a thing on. You know, all the people that were involved in the mass had some Halloween costume. And somebody was recording it. And then they put it out and made it available so we could see what was going on, you know, because there were a lot of liturgical abuses going on after Vatican II that were really horrible.
But I think now a lot of those guys have left or retired.
A lot of that has gone by the wayside, yeah.
It's interesting.
It's
but we had polka masses in Wisconsin. Jim's mother had Alzheimer's, so every time they'd straight up a polka, she didn't know it was the mass.
What's a polka?
Dancing?
The music was polka.
Oh. Can you start dancing?
It'd be hard to be getting in.
Would that be? I mean, they did it regularly.
Yeah, well,
it's the devil. Well, yeah, it's these people.
A lot of it had to do with up in Erie in particular. They had a real problem with vocations, because the young men that were wanted to be priests would look at what was going on, and they'd apply to some other dioceses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was happening.
They had
to. That was happening in Chicago too.
Yeah,
we got a priest in our diocese that came. Applied for Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And there's one that's in the paper all the time. I can't think of his name. He does a lot of liturgy. And he was at, I can't remember anything more. But in Wisconsin, they asked him something about, did he believe in women priests? And he said no. And they said, well, obviously you have a bad attitude toward women.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't accept him.
Yeah.
So he came out here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we have those things, they had those things going on. A lot of it was because we had bishops that were not very good bishops, and they were ordaining people who never should have been ordained.
Right.
So we had this thing happening, you know, we had, and that's when we had all the stuff with the abuse cases and all the rest of this stuff happening. So a lot of that was the fault of bad bishops,
right,
ordaining the people who never should have been ordained, and that were not very good bishops themselves. So, but a lot of those guys have retired now, you know, and so things have changed a lot, so you don't see all that stuff anymore.
But one of the ones from Milwaukee was on the bestseller list, the New York, promoting gay.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, when we were up the Adirondacks, I don't want to be, a lovely priest in the rectory, but it's kind of strange. The secretary lived in the rectory.
Well, they all used to.
Yeah.
When I was little.
It was odd. It was a funny feeling. And I went in there one day to get a mass card, and it was like odd seeing this. Just, well, here's my bedroom, and there's Father's bedroom. And I'm thinking, God, who would want to live in a rectory?
But they did. They all did in the beginning.
But, I mean, I'm not saying there was anything wrong.
You know, I don't think there was anything wrong for a lot of it.
And then he was transferred, and she went with him.
Yeah.
But she knew a lot about the seminary.
Uh-huh.
And she said it was all this homosexual stuff in the Diocese of Albany up there.
Yeah.
It was horrible.
Why so many people were leaving.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the time.
Yeah, so I'm glad we got a good diocese here. We got a really good bishop. We got terrific priests.
How did we get so lucky?
I don't know, but I'm really happy we were where we are.
These
things are really, I'm very happy with this diocese.
Yeah. But it's kind of like living in a bubble.
Yes.
Because it's
so good.
And it's so small compared to the rest of the country.
Well,
the rest of the country is getting better. But
Yeah.
I mean, in Buffalo, they closed the seminary.
Sure.
They had a bankruptcy because of child abuse, and they let the filing go longer. And now they did that whole thing where they're, so confusing that we went, we were trying to go to Immaculate Conception Mass. And it was hard to figure it out because they have like they put all the churches in a family group, and it's like five churches, and then there's 8 o'clock at one, and then there's not another one. It's just really limited.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's sad.
And I was like, oh.
Well,
kind of weird.
My friend up in Erie, when he was pastor of four parishes, every month some parish would not have a mass. They'd have different communion service. You know, which is really sad.
She's been going to the same mass for like 30 years, and they got rid of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was asking him, you know, what was going on with the vacations. He said they had a priest up there who just one day decided he didn't want to be a priest anymore.
Yeah.
He wanted to go sell insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So he just left.
Well, that's what they're doing in Wisconsin, too.
No, he just left. Mm-hmm. He went off, got a job as an insurance salesman. Didn't even tell the bishop he was leaving.
He just walked out of the directory
and went to sell insurance, you know. So we are so lucky we have what we have, you know.
Yeah, so we are so blessed, and God put us here.
We are blessed.
I think about that all the time.
I thank God every day for that.
Yes.
And there are some other really good dioceses around the country, you know, like in Philadelphia and Denver and the rest of them.
Nebraska has.
Nebraska is really good.
There's little pockets. You kind of think about when
they're really good.
They say about lights across the country.
And so these are like lights, mm-hmm. like you're saying, lights around the country, and they're going to spread out. It's going to get better
yeah.
around.
Mm-hmm.
So I have hope. So that's the end of eight.
Okay.
I'm not going to start nine now because it's almost
Christmas.
Finished. So we'll,
it's almost Christmas.
we'll finish four minutes early today.
Wow,
so we come
give
back
you a Christmas
after
present.
New Year's,
we'll
right?
give you a Christmas present. We're going to meet after New Year's.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
New Year's Day is on Monday.
Monday.
Of course.
Oh, okay.
So the next Monday.
Be the 8th.
The 7th or something. Mm. Or the 8th. Yeah, I guess.
So we're going to do the 9th, but then when are we going to do the 7th?
After we finish January 9 through 11,
then
we'll
go back
to the 7th.
Okay.
Why did we skip it?
We go back, we go forward.
Yeah.
That's the last one.
Okay.
We're in 6 now.
Did we really miss it? We didn't miss a chapter.
Okay.
My mind is really confused. I never really adjusted from that to those planes.
Okay. Well, I wish everybody has a very happy
and
Merry
too.
Christmas, a very holy Christmas.
So is Mary Beth done with her chemo?
Oh, no. No.
I mean her radiation?
No, she hadn't even started that yet.
Oh.
She has her fourth infusion of this new chemo on Wednesday, assuming her blood looks good enough to do it. And then she's got 8 more after that.
Oh, I thought she was done by Christmas.
The total of 12 infusions.
Mm-hmm.
And then after those 12 are done, then she has her radiation.
Mm. Man, that seems like overkill.
Why? But they were really, because it was aggressive. So they really hitting her.
Well, it was aggressive, but they got everything and they did all the scans and couldn't find any trace of anything else. So it's just like it's more preventive than anything else, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it isn't like she's got a tumor that they're trying to attack.
Yeah.
So they can't find anything, but, you know, she didn't want to take a chance.
Right.
I don't blame
so
her.
Young.
Will she be on medication when she finishes? Because Carol is still on for life,
I don't know. I think there's one that her oncology surgeon told her she would probably be on.
Yeah.
But I don't remember what it is.
Oh.
But I can't be certain about
that. What was that test that she did that gave the number of, you know, the percentage that you might be at risk of getting it again? My husband's cousin was asking me.
Is it a DNA?
It was some test, and you said if the number was higher, she had to do all this treatment, but if it was lower, then she wouldn't get it in 5 years.
OncoScore.
OncoScore. How do you spell that?
OncoScore.
For oncology is cancer.
Yeah, oncology score, basically.
Score. I'll tell my husband to tell his cousin, Marge.
Yeah.
Yeah, she has just...
What stage is hers?